I just want to like just start with just a moment of gratitude today. I'm feeling better.
Good.
Yeah, I drove up from Philly. We're going to have the thing tomorrow. And I was up till like 4 last night putting these slides together. And I think I pushed myself too much. So I was like sort of struggling with the back of the brain migraine a little bit. But it's rolling back. But the gratitude with the scenery, the beauty of this drive up here today, and the sunset and the stars and you beautiful people. I just think it's really important to start from a place because some of this stuff is really heavy. And there is much beauty in the world, and like we're all part of it. So it's a real. Normally, I flew to Tulsa to talk to 12 people. So this is really amazing to like, you know, within 6 months in January to like actually have people in this moment that is meaningful. And I feel like, you know, I'm from Philly. I thought I was gonna fight school closures in Philadelphia, and it turns out like it seems like I'm fighting. Militarized nanotechnology cyborgs now, you know, like some of these things I did not know, but I just, when you keep pulling the threads, and my city, it's a, you know, it's a large city, it's a black city, and it's a very poor city, and it's surrounded by a very affluent community around us, and we have University of Pennsylvania and Wharton Business School, so that we're sort of a test bed, so a lot of these issues that I find at a macro level, then they actually affect people I know, you know, like, and so I have this weird synthesis of like studying things. I actually work when I'm not doing this as my unpaid work. My husband keeps saying, "Can't you make it a hobby?" I can't make it a hobby. But when I'm not doing this work, I work at a botanic garden that's part of the public park system, and so that is actually what keeps me grounded on land. But we're being meddled with by Comcast, and they want to put their industrial Internet of Things agricultural sensors in our sacred land, and they want to MIT wants to put a big glowing orb in the river next to us, which, you know, who knows, it looks a little cultish, you know, and the Knight Foundation is giving us money to, you know, they're the head of the Internet of Things. And so there's things even just directly where I work and where I'm a part of that are part woven into this. So I feel like sometimes regular people can unexpectedly fall into something that they feel like they're supposed to do. And when I first spoke with my friend Chris, he farms. We have 3 acres, this urban farm youth program, and he's very religious and a farmer and grounded. And he's like, "Allison, you're a Jeremiah." And I'm not very religious, so I had to go look it up. And then I thought, really? You know, like, it wasn't so great. But I guess I'm here to tell you the Babylonians are coming, and they're pretty much Eric Schmidt. So who am I? Much of my work, I wander around the internet. I sort of like put this like burrs on a dog, like, and I bump into things, and I think things get put in my path, people get put in my path, and so my background is actually art history and historic preservation and cultural landscapes, which is kind of a weird thing. I hate finance, I hate computers, I hate all the things that I had to figure out to try to put this puzzle together, but I'm pretty good at the puzzle. And I keep saying I would love for someone to find the thing to say, "Allison, you missed this part and you're totally wrong," because that would be great. So far I haven't found that. But you know, I look a lot of the work that I do, I'm looking at LinkedIn profiles, World Bank videos, the 990 tax forms, grants, just to piece it together. And it's amazing. Like, this, people say, "Oh, it's a conspiracy." I'm like, it's not actually hidden. Like, if you go looking for it, like, if you look in people's LinkedIn profiles, they brag about what they're doing. They just don't imagine that anyone who would be against their program would think to look at their LinkedIn. So, I don't know, there was somebody on social media yesterday who was connected to Finclusion in blockchain identity with the World Bank, and she's in Israel, and, like, someone had shared my piece, my draft of my speech tomorrow. And the woman said, "Oh, no, there's a grain of truth in there, but no, we're all really, really good." And so I'm like looking at her LinkedIn going, "Yeah, you're with blockchain Finclusion, right? You know, here's some things." And so you can find a lot out that way. Augmented reality and mixed reality is a really important concept for us. I don't know how many people are familiar with this idea. Essentially, like, Pokemon Go is the test balloon for this. But in the future, the world may look like the world you see, but is layered with information and like passcodes and coding into it. And that's what's coming with the Internet of Things and the Internet of Bodies. And some of the Internet of Things are down to the level of dust. So things could look just like a regular, you know, city block, farm, garden, but they're layered, and initially it will start off with QR codes. You know, we're already seeing that, right? Like the QR code menus and the QR codes in other countries to get in stores. But there's information that's passing through between the built environment and the digital world. And it's this, like, fusion of humans and computers. So because of all the information that sits in my head, like, I walk out, and my family is so sick of me. They're like, you know, Mom, you know, you're always talking about, oh, this person is actually, you know, all of the stuff behind that. So I kind of see the world with these lenses of augmented reality. But that's an important piece. And like I said, Knight Foundation is part of this, and Niantic, which was behind Pokemon Go. So Niantic was created by Gilman Louie, and they got the startup money from InQtel. So InQtel is the venture capital arm of the CIA. So when you're understanding the world of augmented reality, it's important to understand that it's a fundamentally militarized world and a surveillance world, even though it might be fun like Pokemon Go. Some people think that that's a fun thing. And now we're working to have all of that coded in. So I make these giant maps. The people who fund this software, it's called Little Sis. They're the bad people. You know, like, you know, Open Society funds this and other things, but they haven't kicked me off yet. They don't collaborate with me. They don't really like, I don't think anybody is interested. They have these little target groups in different cities to do, like, you know, research. And then nobody was ever interested in my research, you know, in those groups, because I was looking at really at the whole structure, which included, it's fully bipartisan. In fact, at this point, the liberal and progressive side is scaring me more in some ways. But I make these giant maps. And so this one, ironically, was from a prosperity symposium last year with the Philadelphia Federal Reserve about poverty, moving poverty. So this is sort of what I do and how I think, and it's like a mind map. So you create, there's a database that sits behind that, and each bit has a record, and each record has a white paper. So other people can look at this and click in and follow my path and add on to it or take away. So that's sort of my process. And, you know, I have a lot of slides tonight. I'll see how many I can get through before we start getting rammy, but this is a hyper object. Like, it really is so big. It's like every bit of life is embedded in this augmented reality world. So I started out, they closed our schools. They used our test scores to close our schools. I got involved in the opt-out movement. I organized nationally. With that, I know that there was like a quite active group in New York around that, different across the political spectrum. And I thought that that's how I fell into all of this. The teachers couldn't come. They were busy. They were overwhelmed. They even though I put the information together, I worked really hard, and it never really clicked with them. And so then we have poverty. We also have the center of the opioid crisis, the heroin epidemic in Philadelphia. So then I started organizing with the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign and Sherry Hunkala. So I did that for a while. And then, you know, but really what took hold was once the pandemic, like those first couple days, I knew. Like, and so it was terrible for everybody to have this sense of a pandemic or what was going on and not knowing the nature of the situation. But I knew that was the trigger event for everything that I've been researching for the past. And it's only been 3 or 4 years. People say, oh, she's been doing it for decades. No, I haven't really. I've only been, and you don't get a credential in this. There's no degree you can do doing it. You could do it too if you wanted to, but it's not a hobby. So it's this hyper object. And so it's almost like everything is part of it. And once you get the lens and you have the schema, you peel back and see. So I sort of threw up this idea of the you know, Millennium Falcon in the space worm, right? Like, you're in this worm and you think it's like a landscape, but it actually is a worm, and the jaws are closing. And so I feel like right now, especially with New York, with where you guys are, with this pending vaccine mandate, like the jaws are closing. So I'm trying to use this opportunity to raise some red flags. So again, this is just a slide that speaks to spatial computing and mixed reality. And what's really important to know is that, so you see these folks, they have augmented reality glasses. It's probably going to be less virtual reality, like the full-on face, but more augmented. And haptic controllers. So, like, I'm not a gamer, but, you know, that's how people, you know, play the video games. And what they're visualizing in the next decade is haptic robotics. So that if you imagine the next phase of globalization being not just, you know, outsourced call centers or outsourced, you know, coding work or, you know, that level of, you know, VIP kid online teaching, but that it actually goes to the point that you could do micro work assigned by artificial intelligence anywhere in the world for the cheapest price if you have the right credential. And someone puts on a haptic suit and they run the factory like six countries over. And these very advanced factories that are going to be created are very expensive, so they're going to find the place that is the most stable, as they understand it, from an environmental, like climate crisis point of view, from a social crisis point of view, and they're going to build their factory, and they're not going to like really bother to have many people there. They're going to have the people in Bangladesh or Finland or other places put on the haptic suits and run their stuff, and that's sort of what this next level of globalization 4.0 is coming, and that's coming out of the World Economic Forum. So, it's hard to imagine how quickly these things go, right? But I think even this past 8 months, how quickly things become normalized. So I think that's what they're looking like in the next 10 years. So, again, just to touch on, this Niantic, they're looking at an operating system for the world. Again, it's essentially as if the world were remade by the CIA to profit hedge funds. Yeah.
I was just wondering, it's amazing. Could you speak a little bit slower?
Slower, okay.
I know,
yeah.
We'll be here all
Sorry.
Night,
yeah.
But
yeah.
It's so fast and so good.
Right, yeah.
And I'm old.
Sorry. But this character, I don't know if any of you guys recognize him. His name is Michael Crowe. He's the board chair of InQtel. He's the president of Arizona State University, and he's also a partner in Ridge Lane. LP, I think, Tom Ridge, Homeland Security. So Ridge Lane, you should look them up. They have whole divisions. They're remaking real estate, IT, sustainability, and education. And so this is part of the full-on reimagining the world in augmented reality under surveillance of the CIA. And ultimately, the goal is to use us as data, both as sort of almost like batteries to run these futures markets and new financial products that I will talk about, to service people like Paul Tudor Jones, who is of Tudor Investments in Connecticut. He runs the Robinhood Foundation. His money is channeled through Robinhood Foundation, and they've built up the research behind this in the Harlem Children's Zone for the past 30 years with Stanley Druckenmiller. So Stanley Druckenmiller is George Soros' partner. They shorted the British pound together. So it's all very woven in, but we have to understand the world they're building, the nature of it. It's a militarized world for hedge funds and state surveillance. So I don't know if any of you guys recognize her, but I just to start off early, so Robin Wolkemmer, this is the balance, right? So I think, again, all of this can feel very overwhelming. So being in New York, I couldn't help but reference Dr. Kimmerer's book, Braiding Sweetgrass. So what she says is we have to be the Tinder carriers, the Tinder fungus, and that is our job. And so sometimes I go out and people say, well, Allison, if you don't have the plan, why are we even bothering? If you don't have all the people lined up, why are you, what's your answer? And I'm like, we have to build it. We actually have to build it, but it's enough each individual person to carry the good parts forward. So it's not, so for every Michael Crowe, then you have this a wonderful, author. She is a professor at the forestry school and a biologist, indigenous biologist. And so she comes at the world, and in this moment of science, ruled by science, the idea of indigenous knowledges and knowledges of nature and the world, I think really ground me, are really important to think about. That the world of life that's grounded in the real world and the real thing, and then this militarized faux world that's being built. So there's a book that I highly recommend if you guys are looking for a book to read. It's a really important context. It's called Surveillance Valley by Yasha Levine. Everybody talks about Shoshana Zuboff since surveillance capitalism. There's no answer coming out of Harvard Business School, I'm sorry to tell you. Yasha Levine's book, it's a military history of the Internet, and it's really important in that regard. And that's how I found out about Norbert Wiener, who was the father of cybernetics. And so he essentially helped launch, the beginning of AI and human-machine interfaces. He almost was a genius, and he in World War II, he would calculate missile trajectories in his head. He was down at Aberdeen Proving Ground, and then he created this. But later in his life, he realized what he had done. It was kind of like the Manhattan Project. What do we actually do here? And so, he described a day when the machine was the equivalent of slave labor. And so any labor that competes with slave labor must accept the economic consequences of slave labor. Mm-hmm. And so that is what we're at now with this fourth industrial revolution sort of out on the horizon and going quickly, is that they are looking to replace many careers, jobs, meaningful work. And again, you know, maybe there are some jobs that, that merit, that are not pleasant jobs or whatever, that could be automated, but they would like to automate, you know, teaching, healthcare, you know, childcare, elder care, farmers, everything. Everything's a robot. Robots for everybody. And then what is knowing the power disparity that we have right now and the wealth disparity, that is not going to go well. I mean, I think some people on the left sort of like, great, capitalism is falling apart and now is our turn and we're going to get our stuff and we'll sit in hammocks and we'll write the great American novel. That is not what Michael Bloomberg and Bill Gates have planned. So I think this is really important. But again, he was saying this, Norbert Wiener, in the early 1950s. And it hasn't happened yet, right? So we're 70 years down. It hasn't fully happened. So I think we still have time, but it's something to take into account. And the other piece I wanted to bring in is, especially as we talk about fighting for our freedoms, and I think there are a lot of folks who lean on, like, the Constitution, the Founding Fathers, and all these things, and I think especially here, and this is, like, what really resonated with me, is, like, in the Iroquois Confederacy, and like, we are here because we have built a nation on land theft and genocide and enslavement and unfree labor. Like, and that's just what it is. Like, not from an, I think a lot of times the identity politics stuff doesn't help, but from a political economic system, we never dealt with that, and now it's all of us. Like, it's really all of us. And so we need to find a way, I think, to move forward in unity with this, because it is the doctrine of discovery, which was part of, is it Sherrill versus Oneida, you know, the Ruth Bader Ginsburg decision nobody wants to talk about, like, where they were, like, slapping down indigenous, like, land rights. But it's all of us now, so we need to know this history and understand this as a colonial project, because really what they are seeking to do, a big part of the Fourth Industrial Revolution, is synthetic biology, right? It's CRISPR, it's nanotech, it's things that may not be consensual, right? And it may be built into our environment and contaminants that we don't even know about at this point. We are being colonized down to our DNA. Really. So I think that framing it helps me a lot to think about that. And these are just some, you guys might be familiar with this already, but I think, you know, people who are not steeped in the vaccine, who haven't spent the time to look into it, I mean, they are literally looking at creating biosensors. And this is DARPA. This is, you know, a DARPA project. And they're framing this as the future of pandemic preparedness. And then Moderna, which is, you know, in the lead among these vaccines, is they're framing it as the software of life. And again, I would just ask what kind of life, like, who gets to decide what kind of life that is? That is a cyborg life, a population level bioengineering. And that is backed by Gates. And I had not looked into, but graphene. So graphene is the first, I guess, two-dimensional material, and it's all central to nanorobotics. Like, they actually have nanotech that can self-assemble in you. Like, and it doesn't come out. You know what I mean? And there's a whole EU division on graphene, the graphene flagship project. I had never heard of graphene until like 2 months ago, right? But, you know, they're talking about biosensors, neural interfaces, and drug delivery programs. And so really, we are, our bodies are being used to extract profit for pharmaceutical companies in this biosecurity state. The other piece that I was talking with a friend. She's an amazing researcher as well, in a lot of different areas. She's actually an energy healer and had been a targeted individual. But, you know, we were talking about the brain, right? Like, we know, I don't know whereabouts in upstate, MK Ultra, right? Like, I mean, that's Jonathan Marino, who's a professor, a bioethicist for, you know, at Penn, but his father was part of MK Ultra somewhere up in upstate New York. Now we're looking at mind control, like, we're actually talking about using neural dust and other things to both enhance soldiers. They call it dual use. Like, you know, they'll frame it, they'll develop something for a medical purpose, you know, but they're actually using it for militarized purposes, and it's very unclear in what ways it could be used on domestic populations. And again, whether or not that's agreed upon or you have a right to refuse that, or if you would know. And I think some of us are all still struggling with, like, what happened to everybody? You know, at least for me, I was like, all the people I thought would be with me were, like, with me on all the education stuff when this happened, and I knew exactly what it was about. I mean, I wasn't sure, honestly, at the beginning, if it was potentially a military exercise that had a real component. Like, I wasn't, like, I was willing to hold out for a while to see. But I'm like, all of the people who are still out there denying the Great Reset and what it means, you know, I'm like, they specifically, James Giordano, he's based at Georgetown, so these are all very prestigious individuals. This is, he's presenting at the Modern War Institute, which is at West Point, again, New York. He's saying the brain, the mind is the battle space, and that they can immobilize the enemy. They can stop people from fighting back. And so, you know, I think it's, and I can't prove any of these things, but I mean, this is from 2 years ago at West Point, and they're talking specifically about immobilizing people from engaging. So again, this is just to sort of touch on a bit, a piece of what I'm going to be talking about is blockchain. A lot of these systems, blockchain is going to be what connects us into the Internet of Bodies and smart environments, and it will be logging information in perpetuity in these digital ledgers.
Could you say that word again, block?
Blockchain, like children's blocks, and then a chain. And there was a book that I read, I think it's called The Half Not Told, about capitalism and slavery, and the way in which value was extracted. I'm trying to remember his name. I think Edward Baptiste's book. It's also very good, talking about cotton, the cotton industry, and how they continue to extract more and more profit from physical bodies. They're like, usually when you get more profit, it's because you have an improvement in a machine, right? Like you improve, but the machine were enslaved people. And essentially what he was able to document was that under threat of torture, they increased their cotton harvesting production so much faster because they got people to use both hands. And essentially it made people dissociate. You know, like they were using bodies in ways that they were never meant to be used. And so I think this idea of blockchain accounting systems, what's coming with these, the financial pieces that I'm going to be talking about, the legal firms are very much embedded in it. Like I know that the event tomorrow is targeting the Bar Association. They're part of Pay for Success Finance, right? The lawyers are going to be setting this up. The accountants are going to be setting this up. And so when the transatlantic, like maritime trading laws, that was double entry bookkeeping, was right at the same time, right? And a lot of that maritime trade was in bodies. Well, now blockchain is the new decentralized accounting ledger. And so I just want to make it very clear that these financial transactions in human capital are something that have a very long history. And we deserve to, like, we need to remember that thinking forward. And so I take a lot, when I think about these things, I think about, like, how do we resist? And there have been people who've been resisting empire, you know, and domestic imperialism, like imperialism within our borders, for centuries, right? And so, like, what gives me a lot of hope is looking at, like, indigenous sovereignty movements, right? John Trudell has been a big influence, like, his work, and I'm going to reference him tomorrow. But also Marinage and those Caribbean slave revolts, right? And so how did people have they over time refused to be erased and struggled against these systems where the odds seemed really out of their favor, and honoring that struggle as we go forward, because I think as we grow our ranks, my goal would be that we come up with a struggle that we are all in it together for the right reasons. So Klaus. So Fourth Industrial Revolution, this is the face of the Great Reset. You know, he's been at it since the 70s. And, you know, a lot of folks I know about Bill Gates. For New York, Michael Bloomberg is super important. And I would say I don't think enough bloggers and speakers really speak to the role of Michael Bloomberg as the person who is really... Bill Gates is going to get everyone on blockchain, but then Michael Bloomberg is going to run the policing smart cities. He's going to run the global police state for finance. And his background, so he was... the ambassador to the World Health Organization, he was ambassador for climate change, so all of the sustainable development goals he has his hand in. And his background is he graduated from Johns Hopkins, so he essentially owns Johns Hopkins. He owns the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, is named after him. Event 201 was his thing. But he's an electrical engineer. Michael Bloomberg is an electrical engineer. That was his undergraduate at Johns Hopkins. And so he comes at all of this. His fortune was made in data analytics. Right? And so if what you understand about what's coming in a world of augmented reality is that the people who can predict, who have access to the most data, can shape outcomes or short outcomes, that is tremendous power. And so he's had long-standing relationships with Microsoft, with domain awareness system, right? So the ubiquitous surveillance system that they built, New York City built with Microsoft, and then franchised, Okay, and like the there are seats in domain awareness systems in the headroom for the Federal Reserve and Goldman Sachs and these finance companies in the smart policing state. So Michael Bloomberg is also behind something called What Works Government. So it's framed, and a lot of this is you have to tease apart what they're really saying. They say, you know, data-driven government, e-government, efficiencies, transparency, accountability. That's how they frame it. But he's bought hundreds of Midwest, like governments of Midwestern cities, also cities in Europe and India. And he's dabbling in Israel too. So essentially he's got the apparatus, and even if he doesn't have the politician necessarily, and again this is fully bipartisan, he has the data analysts and the bureaucrats and all of this stuff. So once government becomes sort of run by algorithm, you can just swap out who's standing in front of the algorithm, but the algorithm doesn't change. And so that's why it's really important for New York to understand the Bloomberg connection. So for people who aren't familiar with the Fourth Industrial Revolution, I just want to hit on some of the elements. So automation is a big one. So again, what we're looking at with this whole the whole COVID situation and the vaccine mandates and the vaccine certificates and the digital identities that will go with it is about managing excess labor, right? So the last time they had, you know, the excess labor in the 80s, they, you know, black and brown people, oh, what do? Well, we will put them in jail and then they're more, we can extract profit from them in jail. They were excessed as globalization starts. What happens when you have this next phase of globalization and robots are taking over? You have so many more people that are dispossessed. And I was just listening to a book coming up this morning, Custer Died for Your Sins, and they were talking about pushing indigenous people off the land and making them dependents and calling them incompetent and making all their decisions for them. And that's really what we're looking at right now, is that how will Bill Gates and Michael Bloomberg and Cuomo and Eric Schmidt make money off of people when the robots are doing the work? And it's not because they're going to give us a hammock and, you know, and some watercolors and tell us to have fun and write poetry. That's not how it is. They want to turn us into data. So the automation is a big piece. I touched on telepresence labor. You know, that started with drone warfare, right? Like drone warfare was early telepresence labor with haptics. Artificial intelligence and machine learning and the Internet of Things and ubiquitous computing. And also synthetic biology. So all of these things are generating data. And I think what I didn't realize, I went through a phase of really focusing on educational technology and as a surveillance and a profit center. And I came across Werner Vinge. He's a professor emeritus at UC San Diego in computer science. And he also writes science fiction. And so he wrote a book called Rainbow's End, which is sort of a near future world of augmented reality and wearable technology. But, you know, he first posited the singularity, which is like general artificial intelligence, like attaining consciousness, right, outside of human control. And you know, once I realized that part of this, you know, I think you hear it with Musk, you know, getting out ahead, is that we have to merge with computers, or, you know, the singularity is going to happen. So we have to understand that all of the data we throw off is hastening that process. Whether or not they can actually accomplish it, I mean, I don't have the technical expertise to speak to if they can actually do it. But it is feeding the algorithms and training the algorithms. And I was probably one of the only parents in the Philadelphia Public School District that we refused Google Classroom for our child when they were in school. So they went through 13 years. And Google came in, and most districts, they've taken over all the email accounts. So it would say philsd.org on the end, the kid's name, and fill it, but it was a Google account. And all of the teachers were working through Google Classroom. And so before I even understood about the algorithms and the machine learning, I was like, well, that's surveillance. You know, and also intellectual property. If all of the work that you're doing is put and uploaded into Google, but essentially with our Gmail accounts and with our Google Classrooms and our, also, I mean, this is a Google SlideShare, but we're training the machine to replace us. And that's something I think people are not thinking about, and teachers are not thinking about, that when they're running all of their classes on Google Classroom, they're, you know. And then eventually we're getting to quantum computing, and then 5 and 6G digital twinning. So can you raise your hand if you've heard of 6G? To some of you. Yeah, I hadn't until recently. But the papers, there's a number of papers. If you go to Little Sis and put in digital twinning, but that's the idea. And this is really about industrial engineering and gambling. But the digital twinning, I had sort of an online exchange with someone on one of my blog pieces or videos who was in the, he was at work for a company that did digital twinning. And I said, well, you know, it's we're next, right? Like, he's like, no, but I'm doing a machine, right? Like, I will model I'm modeling an engine, right? And then you can tweak the engine in the digital twin and see how to improve in performance. But really what they're looking at doing is they want a digital twin of every person in the world now. And then they actually have these simulations that were set up, I'm trying to remember if it was at Purdue, where they can model out the scenarios, you know, the military, but like literally with digital people. And I made a wonderful friend through these weird digital spaces, but he has spent 30 years, I'm not sure. Yeah, maybe. I see the screen here. But he's designed video games. He's coded games and done AI and blockchain. And he, in the last 5 years, started to realize how it was all converging in really sinister ways. And he's, you know, having 30 years in, very experienced. A lot of the younger people, it's just like bells and whistles, and they don't think that it could be scary. They don't see any of the danger. But he saw the danger, so he's actually right now building a game to try to explain this so that you could actually play it and see what it means to live in an augmented reality police state. But, you know, he has these characters that they actually code and build, and, you know, then until you load them all up, they just sort of stand there like droopy. But I think that's... The digital twinning thing is really important. I'm not sure. Did I... Oh, there we go. Yeah. So digital twinning is also part of, like, the transhumanism piece. And I think for me, this is something that, you know, I had limited success with all my previous audiences, and then pandemic happened, and the people who like immediately got me were like people of a strong faith practice, but all kinds, like a spiritual practice, and holistic healers. Those are my people. And those wasn't anything I really had experience with, but they were like, we're with you. Like, we got you. Like, we understand what this is. And so I think understanding transhumanism and these digital twins and the break in the natural versus the, mechanistic, is that there is a spiritual thing going on here, right? And they would seek to, like, harvest us and make us this anti-life version of ourselves. And it feels like very much, and maybe I'm going over the top here, but it does feel like a battle of good and evil. Like, it feels like if we are here in this moment and we can see this, like, if we are willing to stand and look at it, like, we're here for a purpose. Like, we're here for a purpose. So, So I think if we seek
to harvest us and
I think to disconnect our spirit from the land. I mean, so we have their natural energy systems of the earth and the cosmos, and that's what I love so much about Robin Wall Kimmerer. Her other book is about moss. That's her specialty. She's a biologist. She studies moss. So I keep thinking when I have these bad days, like, well, Michael Bloomberg can maybe control this layer, this slice of the world or life, but he's not controlling the moss, and he's not controlling the star, you know, the stars really. Like, the world is much bigger, and I think, I don't know, for me, even thinking back to, different quantum dimensions or physics or string theory, and I don't have the answers on all of these things, but if we're supposed to just sit back and fight DARPA, like, out DARPA, like, I don't think that's going to work. So there's some other tools out there in the beauty of the world and our spirits that we can take this on. And I think they would like to, like, push us into the virtual world to control us, both for profit and to manage us so that they can dominate us. But I think there is actually something about trying to disconnect our beingness, because I think we're way more powerful than they want us to know. And so the digital twinning and reducing us to data that can be engineered is something I think a lot about. So I'm going to talk a little bit about financial markets and reskilling. You know, so they've, like, cleared the deck on a whole bunch of jobs, and now everybody has to be reskilled for the fourth industrial revolution, which means you can code the digital jail or you can build the cyborg pharmaceuticals. I think that's what, is it? Murphy in New Jersey, so Governor Bill Murphy, yeah. Like, so he has these new career impact bonds that you can essentially do green energy, big pharma, or coding boot camps. Those are the three things that you're allowed to do now. But skills is really huge because it's a financial market. And the guy, one of the people who is behind the skills, his name is Pavel Luksha. And I would encourage, especially if you're interested in the education space, there's something called Global Education Futures. Global Education Futures. And Pavel Luksha started it. His background is actually in mining, which is interesting. But he's from Skolkovo in Moscow, which is sort of the Silicon Valley and he's a transhumanist, and he thinks that we should upload our consciousness to the internet, and that's how things are going to go. And so what he has been working, collaborating with MIT, right? And so I do have some like thoughts about MIT Media Lab and Joy Ito and Epstein giving them a lot of money about dissociation and digital copies of experiences and these mind uploads. Because this is all, it sounds crazy, but this is literally Pavel Luksha's slide lecture called NeuroWeb. And he's saying, like, this is what we're doing. We're planning on doing mind consciousness uploading. So a lot of this is about commodities. Like, I don't think, I mean, we think about enslavement, right? Like, we think about slavery as a whole, but I don't think most people would think of an enslaved person as a commodity per se. Like, that's not, we think of it as slavery, we don't think it as a commodity. But there's a good talk by a guy, his name is Calvin Schermerhorn, and it's Supply Chains and Commodity Chains, and it's about the finance of the domestic slave trade. So when they stopped this transatlantic, but continued it, they were moving enslaved people from the Chesapeake Bay tobacco area into the sugarcane plantations in Louisiana. And so there was a whole financial apparatus that had to happen because the currency was different. And there was, New York City was playing a huge part, both in the industry and the transfer of that. There was a whole system set up of hypothecation, which was drawing value out of bodies that you controlled. And so the Bank of Louisiana that enabled bonds in enslavement was tied to this concept of hypothecation. And that's really what's coming up, is that we're going to be considered commodities and predictively profiled based on our perceived value to this new system, this anti-life system. So Eric Schmidt is the one who's like, data is the new oil. So and where is that data going to come from? It's going to come through educational technology, the telemedicine sector, nanorobotics, and smart housing. So the housing is really important too. And it may be less so out here, but looking at like 3D printed like housing, manufactured housing with smart devices. So there's a company in Austin that's doing tiny houses, but they look really cool, right? Like they look like mid-century modern, like everything in a, you know, but it has 60 Internet of Things sensors in it. And they've been piloting on refugees, because a lot of this is piloted through humanitarian aid on Syrian refugees, where they have retinal scans. Like, you have to have a retinal scan to get in your house. And so the level of surveillance in Panopticon, like, they know what your temperature is. They know, like, when you got up in the morning. They know, actually, they've even talked about that there are toilets now, in terms of biometrics, that have sphincter biometrics. Right? And so, like, there are markets where they're going to talk about, like, well, we will pay for sanitation in developing worlds, but we need to have a payoff in a medicalized cost offset, right? Like, we're going to pay for it by saying we are improving health metrics. But we need to know how often the toilets were used and by whom, so we can carry it against their electronic health record and know if they got, you know, an illness, you know, if we mitigated that illness that was based on bad sanitation. And that is the aberration of the world of people who think they can engineer everything. I mean, it's a sickness, and that's why I keep sort of getting back to it. I think it's a Western sickness of, like, the brain of having that level of control.
Allison, can you just say what the Internet of Things and the Internet of Bodies is?
Sure. Okay. So the Internet, so they have developed sensors that transmit information. It can be just very simple information or complex. So our phone is an Internet of Things. Like, it's like the most common one, right? And there's a lot of data that is collected. But they're actually putting sensors as small as dust into everything, like pavement. Like, in Colorado, they're trialing sensors in highway pavement. So as you drive on it, like, there's data interfaces going on. And there's, like, huge concerns over also the EMF radiation related to all of this signaling, and you know, we're mostly water, right? So all of these waves, you know, many scientists have expressed concern to the World Health Organization, the United Nations, about this, but all of the United Nations are in on the game of the Fourth Industrial Revolution, and they're not going to. It runs on the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things is what will make augmented reality. But it could be as simple as a QR code. It doesn't actually have to be super sophisticated, because that's the thing, and it holds data. You're in this store, and it links to the date, right? So they can be very low tech. Michael Bloomberg actually put a bunch of unhoused people on blockchain in Austin for a pilot as part of ID 2020. It's just a QR code. Like, they gave the unhoused people, I guess they didn't feel like giving them a phone, so they just gave them a laminated card with a QR code on it that would have all their data that would be unlocked. So that's generally the Internet of Things, but it's smart street lamps, right? Like, that's part of it is an urban infrastructure. If you've noticed a lot of the new LED street lamps going in, I mean, maybe not out here, but in the cities, they're putting them in everywhere. Philadelphia, and this is why I kind of love Philadelphia, is because we're so half-assed about things, that gives me some hope. Like, our first smart infrastructure was big belly trash cans. These, like, they were supposed to sell, like, I'm full, I'll compress myself, and then eventually send a signal for someone to come pick me up. And it was supposed to be efficiency but we never plugged them in, I think. So they just sat there like regular trash cans. So, like, it does give me some hope that, like, but, like, who would think that, like, this stupid trash can is, like, part of the, like, militarized takeover of the world? Like, you wouldn't really, you know, like, I hate those stupid trash cans. But, like, that's how they started. Smart trash cans, smart lights, smart pavement. I think they're like smart paint. You know, but it's, and what's so upsetting about it is it's all being pitched as sustainable, right? And it's green. We're going to have green smart cities. But yeah, efficient, cost. But they don't talk about, like, the energy, the water to cool the data centers, the child, you know, miners in Congo mining the minerals that were, like, taking over Brazil for the lithium, or Bolivia for the lithium. Like, that once we have all these devices, like, all these Chromebooks, this is planned obsolescence. They last maybe 2 years, and then they go in the landfill. Like, it's not green. They want to say it's green, but it's all set up this way because the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, of which there are 17, and unless you actually look at them, most of them are poverty management. They're about people. They're not actually about the environment. Like, they're not really about water. Like, there are about four or five that are actually about, like, air and water and things. And the rest are people, managing people. And it's being managed for financial markets that I'll talk about further. But all of it has to be run through a device, or it doesn't work for the financial markets. So they're going to tell everyone, Greta is going to go out and tell everyone that we have to, you know, be green and swallow our nano pills so that we can have the best telemedicine, you know, in this new fourth industrial revolution world, when really it's a very twisted and toxic environment that they're building. Oh, sorry, did I lose it? There you go. Okay. So Internet of Bodies, I guess that's also, is the nano pills. Like, so some of it is wearable tech, and I'm going to talk about that later. I mean, wearable tech really is kind of like your phone in your pocket at a basic level. But the Fitbits, you know, now they have brainwave monitoring headbands, like, for meditation and biofeedback. But even, like, swallowing, like, they have, like, medications with Internet of Things pill caps so that they know if you took your pill or not, or at least if you opened the cap or not. But they actually are talking about, like, having things that you swallow. And then with Profusa and those biosensors, like, ultimately, that's an Internet of Bodies thing where it blends with this hydrogel inside of you and you resonate with this mechanized energy source, 5G, you know, 6G, what have you. And so that is coming out of the World Economic Forum. Like, I'm not making this up. It's not just, like, a cute phrase that I use. They have a whole white paper called the Internet of Bodies. And that's how they talk about people. Like, because they're not planning to be in the Internet of Bodies. Like, they probably, like, Richard Branson, he's got his Necker Island down in the Caribbean. Like, they're not going to be in the Internet of Bodies. We're going to be in the Internet of Bodies. Anyway, I just wanted to put this, the reimagining, right? So who is reimagining? Well, there you go. So Eric Schmidt. And Eric Schmidt is reimagining us as his mining commodities. Like, pretty much. That's what Eric Schmidt is reimagining us. And look, everybody's going to be reskilled so that we can mine one another. Geofencing, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the concept of geofencing, but, you know, for me, it was really interesting. I didn't know about Operation Paperclip. like until recently, like when I was looking at all this in terms of like post-World War II, when a lot of the Nazi scientists were brought over into the U.S. and like polished up and put in important positions. And Wernher von Braun like was the head of NASA. And so essentially this global digital jail is going to be run from space. And that's why all of these satellite constellations are going up right now, Kuiper and Musk's and all of these different ones. And so the prison is run on satellites. And so if you understand, it's like it's kind of crazy, but if you reimagine the U.S. space program is run by the Nazis, like it makes a lot more sense, like how this arc of this trajectory is going. But it's so, and that's to get all of the places that don't have the 5G. You know, people say, oh, Allison, you know, it's not in the developing world, but they're going to get them on the satellites. That's how they're going to get them. But the geofencing is this real-time GPS. So, like, really, all the GPS stuff, it gets really creepy when you start saying, like, they know where you are in real time, right? And they can predict you in real time. Geofencing used to be used for marketing, right? And they would put a designation with you know, geolocation coordinates, and if you would, like, have a device on your phone and walk into an area, it would, like, ping, like, here's a special offer on a burrito, or something, you know, or the museums would do them. Like, oh, you walk next to this painting, and ping, there's something on your phone that will tell you about the painting. And so they started off with the geofencing, but now it's morphed, right? And so I think they actually had Minority Report. I don't know if you remember the scene, like, he's walking through, and they're like, oh, how did you like that T-shirt you bought? You know, like everything is very personalized, and it's based on geolocation data and your past history of data. But now they're talking about actually connecting it to, you know, these distance, like wearable technology distance things. So then it starts to get really weird if you start to think about like your pets and the electronic fencing, right? And like livestock. And I used to think it was really like my husband a couple years ago, I don't know, back when it was like a novelty, the great white sharks were tagged and they had names and you'd be like, oh, where is Kate the shark? Oh, they're off the coast of Florida. Isn't that interesting? Oh, then that's now off North Carolina. Well, and actually my child is in college now and they took a class on science from space and they were tracking wildlife populations. And I'm like, just so you know, we're them, right? Like, that's where it's going. So as they have done to the wild animals, then, yeah. So we're in, I don't know if you've heard of James Kilgore. I've been in touch with him. He's an activist around incarceration. And, you know, I was like, Jim, like, James, this is what it is. We have to look at domestic livestock management, like satellite management of domestic livestock, because that's where it's going. Like, that's what it's going to look like. And so you can see this is like context-aware devices and integrated smart environments. But you can see there's the, you know, your transit, your, you know, machine arm, you know, industrial thing, the transmitters. And you can't, if you're on the highways these days, there you can't not see a 5G tower now. I drove out halfway across the country early on during this, and you were never outside the sight line of a 5G tower on the highways now. And drones, right? And then the robots. So up the river from where I work, Penn has a lab called Pennovation, where their GRASP lab, their engineering lab, is building hive mind drones for the Army, right? And so, but they promise they're only going to use them for good things, like saving people, you know, from building collapses or something like that. I don't know. But, like, once you start thinking about hive mind drones for the Army and satellites and knowing your bus route and things, like, it starts getting a bit Black Mirror pretty quick. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So this is just essentially talking about managed from space. But, the United Nations Goal 11 is sustainable cities, and there's the Office of Space Affairs. Like, so there is a very direct connection between the smart city operations and the satellite functioning. And that's why, again, if we think about pollution, like, essentially we are polluting all of the atmosphere with these satellites and the energy that's going to be going along with it. And no one, it's just how it's framed. They want to frame it as, like, efficient and you know, liberating, and I'm saying that it's not. So Common Pass, I don't know, this has been getting more play. Most people are talking about this part. It's important to understand the Rockefeller Foundation's role in all of this. And for people who are more familiar than I was, like in public health, like, you know, Rockefeller, that was, you know, the beginning of, you know, taking over holistic medicine and like shoving it to the side and selling, you know, these snake oil treatments or whatever. But they're also, Rockefeller is key in the impact investing space, which is all around the human capital bond markets. And, you know, they funded with Bloomberg, I think, the modules to train the contact tracers that Johns Hopkins developed those. Like, imagine how that happened, right? But they don't want to just control the air travel. Like, they want to control your access to education and employment, and also your health, which is going to be those biosensors eventually. You know, it may take them 5 years. Like, at the end of the whole COVID scheme, five-year scheme, we'll have the biosensors. But it's much bigger than that. And so this was sort of like a sleeper organization. I looked back. It seems like they got set up last August, and they had one tweet, like a retweet in September, and then went quiet, and then in April came back online. And in July, they have a global board of 60 people. And it's really worthwhile looking to see who their board is, because it is global. And again, none of this just happened. None of this just like popped up, and like in 2 months, they've got this going. It's been planned well in advance. And this is the geofencing, right? So you've got your phone. They can tell you where you go. And one of the things I keep trying to convey to people working on, like, the immigration issues, right? I'm like, they can make a border wherever they want in real time based on whatever information they have. Like, I mean, they have to make it socially acceptable. I thought it was going to be harder to make stuff like this socially acceptable. It seems like, you know, people are going along. But really, in the future, like, the border can be your front door. Like, they can make the border your front door. Because these folks, this is transnational global capital, which is not to say that geopolitics in and of itself isn't a thing and that we can just dismiss it. Like, certainly there's still geopolitics at play. But Jack Ma and the Rockefeller Foundation and Deutsche Bank and the Vatican Bank and, you know, Michael Bloomberg, they're all in the same game. They're in the tier, right? They're in this top tier coordinating this program globally. So for us, like, what I would really like to see is a global movement in opposition, because clearly Common Pass has got it global. And again, just speaking to understanding pass systems, right? Like, let us look, how were pass systems used in the past, right? How are they used in apartheid South Africa? How are they used on Indian reservations? How are they being used, you know, in Gaza, right? These pass systems are used to control and limit people's mobility. So all the data, Internet of Things, sensors, all the same, it doesn't do a thing for people like Michael Bloomberg if it doesn't go somewhere. So disconnected data might have a little bit of use. It's not terribly useful. It's the relationships among the data that are really helpful in making the predictive analytics and creating value. Like, it's you know, I guess, like, different grades of oil or whatever, you know, or different grades of diamonds, right? They want the good stuff, and the good stuff is interoperable data. So what they need is the blockchain identity. And sometimes they call it self-sovereign identity. Like, they want to make us feel sovereign. But essentially, once we agree to this, it's like we've agreed to become their commodities. And they're very sneaky in how they're setting it up, because they're saying, look, you know, privacy. You want your privacy, right? Like, and why should Facebook be making money off you? You could be your own brand. You could have your own digital identity and, like, groom yourself, like, from an early age, maybe even before you're born. Because we can get, you know, we can know, like, you know, how your mom acted, like, while she was carrying you, and feed it all into your digital brand. And so this is really happening. And right now, for the past 5 years, they've been doing pilot projects, right? They have to be able to, they need to be able to scale it, and they need to make it socially acceptable. So among these pilot projects, one of the first ones I saw was Amply, which is in South Africa. Again, the stuff is highly racialized. IXO Foundation and Innovation Edge, I believe, they set up franchise pre-K. And it's a very simple, this is a very early stage. They would reimburse the child care provider for every day the child attended preschool. And the child was put on blockchain, the school was put on blockchain, the teachers are put on blockchain. And they said, oh, we don't want to do paper anymore. You know, it's too messy paper. Let's just have an app. So it's every app, the kid went in, and a blockchain token moved over to get a reimbursement. And they framed it as helping the children build social capital, that the children will be building social capital in preschool. But then also they probably have something knowing, like, did the family bring the kids in late? Were they skipping out? Like, all of these other things. So, and this is backed by UNICEF, too. So, again, the UN. And this is UN Sustainable Development Goal 3 is education. The state of Illinois, which is, I'm sorry, this is so crummy, but this upper one, the FAN, they did a working group in 2018 about blockchain, imagining all the different ways they could use blockchain. And they set up an agreement with Evernim, which is based in Salt Lake City, to do blockchain birth certificates. Okay, so that's early phase. Then there's another company called Idemia. We're starting to see rollout of digital driver's licenses. and that's a big thing that's coming next, is augmented identity. IDEMI is talking augmented identity. And the first blockchain baby. So this is very insidious in Tanzania, and this is part of humanitarian aid, and like MasterCard is connected to this stuff. If you comply with all your prenatal checkups, you earn. It's kind of this weird mashup with like your loyalty cards, you know, at the drugstore or your grocery store or whatever. You prove yourself and they log it and then you get a chit credit. So they're like, if you do all your appointments, you can earn a token for an umbrella and trade it for an umbrella. But they put the women and unborn children on blockchain in Tanzania. And this is like framed as humanitarian aid. And again, I had mentioned about Bloomberg and the people in Austin on blockchain. So these things are going. And what I'm trying to say, like, I'm trying to scream really loud because people are like, that's in South Africa. The next phase, actually, that's even scarier is IO2 Foundation in Shanxi City. They're doing facial recognition. Like, they have these smart contracts that, like, click that something happened. And they're doing home visits. So the past 5 to 10 years, they've been putting home visit legislation all over the country to get into people's homes. And it sounds good, only it's not. So they'll go into people's homes with an iPad and film them being a good parent. And it will fulfill, like, it will fulfill this investment contract. And so that was being piloted in China and Boa Vista, Brazil. So these programs are out there. They're backed with the UN, with hedge funds. The guy... IO2 Foundation, he was, you know, educated in Hong Kong, Columbia University, and London School of Economics. Like, these are worldly people. They travel amongst each other and they plan these things out. And imagine essentially having someone, an officer of the state, come in your house and tell you if you're parenting appropriately and put it on video with your facial recognition and your children's facial recognition and have that be tied to global investment markets. I mean, it's abominable, but if they get away with it, in a cloud-based world, once you have the model, it could be uploaded in anywhere in the world in a month, shorter than that. Like, it's not physically like, oh, we have to build this whole, it's software as service. Once they build it, they can put it anywhere. That's why we need to all be together on this. So anyway, these are, you know, they're talking about COVID credentials on blockchain. If you look up, I mean, this is one of the COVID credentials members, but there were like 60. I can't even, like, I couldn't even put them all in little sis. It's just too tiring and exhausting. But you see Evernym, you see digital twinning. This is iRespond, which is humanitarian aid. And then this one is learning economy, which is essentially about creating a currency and training tokens. And all of this stuff is about tokenizing things. So we're moving to a world of globalization where there's not actually, I mean, we know they're pushing the Fed, you know, dollars, these digital dollars, the central banking digital dollar system. It's going to be like scrip. It really is going to be like scrip that's coming. Like, that won't even be like dollars and things. You'll like, here's you have 3 coins for your housing this month. You know, like, it's, and then they can change it up, you know, and they're already tracking in China, social credit scoring and parolees on blockchain and smart environments. So imagine, and this is what people need to know for the Bar Association, the first social impact bond in the U.S. was at Rikers Island, and it was around youth incarceration and recidivism. And so Bloomberg brought it over from the U.K. for Goldman Sachs. Just a second. I know it's a lot. So essentially, and I was talking about this later, this cost offset, ginormous, like, prison industrial complex cost offset, and they're going to be reskilling all of these people. So imagine you're being put on parole, and all the nonprofits that are servicing you on your reentry are all getting all investment markets, right? And so, and imagine the world is a global digital prison, right, where poverty is still criminalized. And they don't actually want to build all of those giant jails. Because when I was researching schools, I realized these crazy people, they don't want bricks and mortar schools. They want Pokemon Go education where you don't actually have schools. You don't have buildings. You just wander around and collect points. And then occasionally drop in somewhere and have someone give you a consultation on how well you're doing. That's their vision for school. And the same people at the MacArthur Foundation are in prison reform. And I'm like, what are they doing in prison reform? No one's going to build enough prisons to hold all the people displaced by the Fourth Industrial Revolution. They don't want to build that many prisons. They'll just turn the world into a prison. The people who can be off that have their own island without the internet of bodies. And then criminalize poverty and create pathways. And all the nonprofits process the people on the pathways for impact investors. And so really these returning citizens are just a cash cow for the processing. And they're never supposed to actually get out of the system because then their market dries up, which really stinks. So it's important to know there's 10 digital nations. I don't think we're a digital nation, but like Canada, the UK, Australia, Portugal, Uruguay, Israel, South Korea, there's a couple others. They're all going full on e-government, digital identity with your digital driver's license. Oh, Estonia. So Estonia is the model. Estonia is the model blockchain country. Little tiny Tesla. And that's the crazy thing. It's like the Nordic socialist stuff because they actually have the benefits that can be co-opted and people are used to having them. So then there's just like, oh, it's super convenient, like Sweden and the chipping. It's totally enmeshed in all of this. But this is from the Israel's digital government plan. And like I was just looking over that because Israel is actually running the Rhode Island COVID reopen. Like nobody's talking about that. I'm like, why is the Israeli health department running Gina Raimondo's COVID reopen program? And I'm going to be writing up stuff on that, but there's a webinar on my YouTube channel that you can just watch. But like, so let's look at, they're modeling all this stuff on Israel and talking about Estonia and Israel. But they've lifted up this national rights engine, right? The national rights engine. And so I think it's being framed as like, these are your benefits. Like these are your public benefits. Like everybody gets a different one, right? Like depending on who you are. And so if you imagine a world, a smart world, where your rights and privileges are tokenized on blockchain, like whether you can cross your front door or not, you know, whether you can go to school or not, everything is a token and everything is a right or a privilege that you have or you don't have. At what point do constitutional rights or civil rights, do they all get usurped by blockchain smart contracts? Of course, they're coming out the gate like, look at all these things we have for you. Aren't these all very nice things? Only some of you don't get them, you know? And like maybe you have rights when you leave, you know, in the morning, but you end up speaking out on behalf of your rights. And when you come back, your retinal scan on your affordable housing pod doesn't work. You know, that's what, you know, and again, am I saying it's all going to happen? I can't say that it's all going to happen, but I think people need to understand the technology is there, that it definitely could happen if we're not speaking out. So this is just more about blockchain. But this is from this crazy timeline of Pavel Luksha, the Global Education Futures, on their website. They have a timeline. But this is actually talk about people nairs, that fortune's made up of people. And this is the thing I have that's a bit of a challenge with me, like being on someone who's like leans more left with like the free market libertarians, is they, I think there's a whole group of people who are just like, leave us alone, just leave us alone, we have our own town, do our own thing, have our own markets, like, fine. That's not how it's going to go. It's the Peter Thiel big L libertarians that are essentially going to start using these blockchain platforms to invest in people as commodities. And so this is a diagram of how this works with a payment by results system, Alice. Alice is a blockchain investment platform in poverty. So this is the kind of stuff Peter Thiel libertarians are going to be investing in people as poverty. And then this is another sort of free market libertarian publication out of Idaho. And essentially it's sort of like a community blockchain currency, only like you can be invested in like by your church or a local like rich people. And you can program money. You can actually program the money, and that's what I'm talking about, script, is that in Australia, several years ago, they put their disability benefits on blockchain as programmable money. It's called Making Money Smart. You can look up the white paper. So essentially, they're talking about making it all conditional, and you can imagine that you get a digital wallet of tokens for your benefits, but it's all conditional. And then if those benefits are privatized and put in the impact space, People can gamble on you.
Are you, maybe that's what this is, because I didn't understand any of the words you just said about the last slide.
Okay.
But maybe it's going to be answered here.
Yeah.
I don't understand how someone makes money off my poverty.
Yeah, I will get there. Yeah, I'll get there. It's hard to say which thing first. So I'm like, so blockchain, it's important to understand blockchain, interoperability, data in smart environments is commodities. And I have a good diagram that talks about that. But this is just one example in which these pay-for-success finances were creative financing in Connecticut, because all like tons of hedge funds in Connecticut. They set up this intervention with women who were flagged for substance use and child protective service involvement. And so Yale came up with an intervention, an evidence-based intervention for these women. But most, really, these women made $10,000 a year. Right? They're like single women, like trying to raise a family in Connecticut on $10,000 a year. And nobody was giving them any more money, but they were going to have them pee in a cup several times a week and do an intervention. And the deal for that was if they met the performance contract results, which is, this was a government performance-based contract, the investors got payback, like met their performance targets. So in this particular instance, among the investors was BNP Paribas Bank and QBE Insurance in Australia, right? So essentially these women and their situation, their, you know, health situation, their family situation became embedded within a global marketplace. So let me talk to you about how that works. Okay. I'll skip that. But here's John Trudeau. John Trudeau essentially was talking about the guerrilla theater of politics and the audience getting to participate, which I thought was really good for now. So I'll skip a little bit. Some people call this, we're just talking about industrial engineered society. Some people are talking about communitarianism and Amitai Etzioni, technocracy, which Howard Scott, that was out of Columbia University School of Industrial Engineering in Davos. So this thing that is coming is called stakeholder capitalism, the era of stakeholder capitalism, and I thought that sort of gives stakeholder capitalism. There you go. So I know about stakeholder capitalism because they created it, Judith Roden, who is the former president of the University of Pennsylvania where I live, created it when she was the president of the Rockefeller Foundation. And she set it up as the global impact investment network in the years leading up to the last economic crash, which created the stage for poverty by destabilizing everything. And the companies that are going to play this game that we're talking about, the game of pay-for-success finance that I'll get into, and to become stakeholder capitalists, which is making money off of dispossessed people, you need rules. And the rules are the metrics. Because if you have no rules, no one's going to play. And it doesn't really matter what the rules are as long as they all agree that those are the rules. So if you haven't seen The Big Short, the movie The Big Short, watch that movie. The next one is Toddlers and Poor People are The Big Short. But the thing about that is the game goes on as long as the rich people all agree to the rules, even if they make no sense. And that's important to know, because people will say, that doesn't make any sense. And I say, it doesn't really matter. If you're rich and you set the rules and you have the police and the military and the politicians in your pocket, you can play that game. And so that's the game that's coming. So the Rockefeller Foundation funded something called the B Lab, which is in Berwyn, Pennsylvania, which is out on the main line. And they set all of the rules for this new interdependence in the stakeholder. And this is they put this up. They were proud of this. This was in their document. Like, this is how they chose to represent themselves. That's what I'm just saying. Like, this isn't like a take, like a parody of them. This was their document. Like, this was their document from 2009. So, you know, and it kind of disappeared for a while, and then I found it again. Philly, we're going to be an impact economy. Have a lot of poverty. Let me get my diagram. Okay. All right. So it is it's a plumbing problem. It's a circulation problem, right? So capitalism, for it to keep going, it has to flow. The money has to flow. How does capital circulate if nobody is making any money and everybody's in debt? Then you can't buy. You can never. And the world is finite. Finite resources, right? We're going to run out of stuff. Well, essentially what you do is you create a new game where the poor can be gambled on as investment commodities. So that's what's coming. And you do it by partnering government and nonprofits and investors. So it's this public-private partnership program. So that's what you do when you have a lot of debt and poverty, which we have even ever more of with COVID. So they call this several things. They first started out calling them, in the very beginning, in the early mid-1990s, Arthur Rolnick, who is an economist at the Minneapolis Fed, and this guy Stephen Rothschild created performance-based government contracts. Right? Seemed fine. Right? Government, you know, the government would pay for outsourcing if metrics were met, and everybody liked it because the conservatives said, "Well, we're getting good stuff for our money," and the liberals said, "Oh, this is great because people are getting taken care of." So it was bipartisan. So it sat around for a bit, and then around 2010, Sir Ronald Cohen, who was with something called Social Finance, took a whole bunch of money from the UK lottery fund, like the unclaimed money. I think it was called Big Society Capital, not lottery. It was the unclaimed bank accounts. So they had this big pot of money and they said, we're going to come up with social impact bonds to improve society with these social impact bonds. So we're going to do performance-based metrics. And now the technology is caught up with it, right? Like we have the Internet of Bodies and we have the Internet of Things. We have real-time data. We have satellites. We don't need to push paper around. We can start to scale these projects. So he created this idea of a cost offset. Eventually, social impact bonds became pay for success. They couldn't scale them. So pay for success is predicated on the fact that the government can't do it, right? Like they have to outsource it because they're like, we don't have the money really. Like we're so lean, we can't possibly do all the public benefits that we need. So we're going to outsource it. That's based on the austerity. They set a contract based on a metric. So for example, one of the early social impact bonds in the U.S. was in Salt Lake City. It was for pre-K. And they said, you need a cost offset to justify the profit taking. And they would say, if we give at-risk kids pre-K, we are going to reduce the number of kids in needing special education. So if we put a little bit of, you know, if we put this smaller amount of money up now to preemptively fix them, we won't have this later problem that's more expensive, you know. And the difference between what we put into the program and what we have calculated with our equations that the cost would be if we didn't fix it is we get a slice of that and the investor gets paid back their initial investment and the performance target if the metrics are met. So this one, this social impact bond for pre-K in Salt Lake City was backed by Goldman Sachs. So they screened several hundred kids. They put 100 kids in this pre-K program. It wasn't a particularly super well-funded program, but, you know, something. These kids got something. And then at the other end, only one of the 100 kids was screened into special education services, which is crazy because the people who know education would say, if this child was screened as, like, potentially needing them, there's no way only one of the 100 kids got it at the end. So either their screening tool was pulling in kids, maybe English language learners, kids who were never going to need special education, they just need time to catch up, or they were denying kids services, or some measure of both. And I think those of us who understand, like, the gaming that goes on in the charter privatization, you know, things can be gamed. And Goldman Sachs is making a bank. So there's another one in Chicago, and it also ties in third grade test scores and family services. So they pick a number. So essentially what they're saying is they reduce, the service gets redesigned to the number, right? Or the metric. So the pre-K offset was special education. Prison is a huge cost offset. We've been hearing for decades, right? Look how expensive prison is. We spend this much on prisoners. How can we do that? Well, all of that is fully embedded in our consciousness now. It's very expensive. Look, that's a giant cost offset. Maybe we can predictably profile people and keep them out of prison, as though being in prison was necessarily something that was an individual choice as opposed to a structural problem. You know, and it's some, you know, measure of both. And so that's how they have the cost offset. Sorry. I know. I think I lost it. So is it coming back?
This seems to be...
Yeah. Okay. So you have austerity. The government says, we'll pay you if you can provide a quality service. Quality meaning a narrow metric. The investors front the service. The thing is, where is the money? People are like, I don't see why they would do this. There's not that much money in this performance contracting system. Like, you just get a little slice, and maybe you don't even get that if the thing you invest in doesn't work. It's not the deal. But the deals have to exist to securitize the debt. And that's where the money is in the securitization. So they're going to securitize that debt. The people who are in the deal, who maybe never asked to, you know, like, are monitored as data. That's the Internet of Bodies, right? Like, maybe they don't get to opt out of being part of the pay for success. I mean, there's a bunch of kids in Chicago whose third grade test scores are part of Goldman Sachs' pay for success deal. Nobody gave them the option of not being part of that deal. To make it all legit, even though we know the metric is set so that it will preference the investor, because the investor's not going to invest in something they're not going to make money on. Like, the city is going to work with Goldman Sachs. Like, they're going to make it happen for them. A third party will review the data and say, oh yeah, it's a good deal. You met the terms. Well, the crazy thing is, some of the third party reviewers, there are multiple of these pilots in Santa Clara, California, so Silicon Valley. There's a pre-K, an early literacy, a housing social impact bond, and a mental health social impact bond. The mental health and the housing one, the people reviewing the data are Palantir. I'm like, that's Peter Thiel's company. They have contracts with Department of Homeland Security. They're doing like sneaky moves with predictive policing. Like these are not good people, but like now if you're someone who is unhoused in Santa Clara and you need housing and maybe you have someone in your family who's undocumented, well, Palantir is gonna be checking out your data. So that is part of the deal. And then the deal is either found to be legit that it was met or not. But once the debt is securitized, people can also short it. And that's the thing that's really vital to understand is that once it's out on the market, there are people that are, and people say, is this real? No, it's actually real. So this is from 2012, where they're already talking, this is the pre-K finance for social impact bonds, for not just pre-K, but K-12, and workforce, so that's job training, that the assets will be bought and sold by investors, traded worldwide, and aggregated in asset-backed securities. I mean, that's been the plan since 2012. And, let me see. So this is in the process now. So what Phil Murphy, New Jersey governor? Okay. So these career impact bonds, career impact bonds to reskill people, the guy who is part of that, it's all structured debt. It's structured finance. And people don't think, like, why would you do that to, like, pre-K or workforce development? Because it's a commodities market. They're building commodities markets out of dispossession. So Ricardi, he was the grandfather of collateralized debt obligations. Like, he did that. He crashed he was a key figure in the crash of the global housing market. He is part of something called EDLI, which is a platform to securitize debt on these, you can securitize people now on these income sharing agreements. So pre-K, you have social impact bonds. You're probably not going to do an income sharing agreement with a toddler, but you are going to do it for someone who's been reskilled out of their job because they were a cook and their restaurant went out of business, right? You can reskill them to code the virtual jail. And this income sharing agreement essentially says, I don't pay fees for my training, but I agree to sign a contract that you can garnish my wages for X amount of time, assuming I get a job and that meets the criteria in the contract. And then you pull that out. So all of that debt is, I mean, the plan is to securitize it, and Chris Picardi is in on it. I mean, and you can imagine the scale that this is going to happen. So this was in the fall of 2018, and I really actually wanted to go to this event. But Ready Nation, this is Robert Duggar, who worked for Paul Tudor Jones. And Jim Heckman. So the equation that's going to work on pre-K. These pay-for-success deals rely on equations. And I know this is really complicated, but that come out of universities, like the rules. They need the rules of the game. The equation for pre-K investment came from the University of Chicago. It's a Nobel Prize-winning economist. His name is Jim Heckman. It's called the Heckman equation, and the Pritzker family paid for it. So the Pritzker family said, if we can move pre-K data, and what Heckman said is we can't change cognitive data because the IQ hardens up. It doesn't work for hedge funds, but we can change character. So all the stuff about the Ocean 5 traits and personality traits, essentially they're going to digitally brainwash children for profit to make the equation work. So Heckman's equation said it was a 7 to 10% annualized rate of return on pre-K, up to 13, I think, if you had health impacts. So put a Fitbit on all those kids, right? They're all commodities now. And so they met in New York City to launch. It was a global gathering of pre-K. And you couldn't, it actually said on the registration, if you are an advocate for pre-K or children, you can only come with approval of four vetted business people. Like, it said on the registration, they're like, if you're just coming to be an advocate for kids, like, no, you got to be the right people in the room. And so the Amplee people were in the room, and the mayor of Boa Vista that had the tablet, the home visits with the tablets and the smart contracts was in the room. And all these people were in the room, and this is going to, you know, match up. Now, you know, Newsom is talking, all of the Democratic governors are talking pre-K, which sounds good, except when it's based on data commodities. I know this is kind of, but education, this is the new currency. The currency is blockchain education on these income sharing agreements. You know, if you're wondering, Ivanka's on with the reskilling with Mark Benioff, so it's a fully bipartisan there. And, you know, this is a really sad image. So this is actually from a defense contractor in Orlando. Orlando is a center of simulation. And what they're talking about is training kids for this future of work. But they're never going to actually tell you how the whole machine works, because one week you're pushing this button and one week you're pushing some other button. And the micro AI tells you what your work is allowed, you know, on blockchain. You know, these kids are being trained to work in Amazon warehouses. And this is actually in the UK. This is preschool kids in VR headsets. And that is for digital brainwashing. I mean, look at that. That's not right. You're not even supposed to have those things on until you're like 13. And UNICEF is behind a lot of this, and they're piling it in Africa. And they're saying that there is a skills gap with social emotional learning. But virtual learning can provide better access to learning experiences that would be too expensive. So UNICEF is saying, like, kids are having the wrong behaviors, and we're going to train them to have the right behaviors on blockchain with VR. So I'm just going to, we'll have more Q&A. I'm going to just hit some highlights, for these are key people in New York State that I threw together. So I have a blog post called, like, Boiling Frogs and Building Brands. I'm actually, I grew up the kid of a Procter & Gamble executive. My dad sold Folgers Coffee his whole life. And that was like art. My dad sold Folgers Coffee. He worked for Procter & Gamble. And Procter & Gamble helped invent the Internet of Things. And I'm trying to remember the guy's name. He was tracking Oil of Olay lipstick. And it was the RFID chip. And they said, that's the thing. Why don't you go to MIT? You're going to scale that. Now there's 8 auto ID labs. But Procter & Gamble was very good at both supply chain tracking and selling you things, right, in advertising. And they're based in Cincinnati. So KnowledgeWorks and Strive Together are key players in this space. KnowledgeWorks in killing off bricks and mortar schools and having Pokemon Go education and badges. And then Strive is the human capital pipeline. They call it cradle to career pipeline. Strive is working with United Way and Steve Ballmer's wife from Microsoft is on their board. And literally they are building like Internet of Things supply chains of young children in these collective impact programs that are at least in 70 communities all over the country already. I mean, they're not all on with Amplee yet, and they don't all have blockchain identity yet, but that is this larger plan. So Nancy Zimfer was part of that, and she was the president of the University of Cincinnati before she came to New York State. So essentially, like, when you're like looking at the decimation of what's going to be coming with the higher education system here, like, that Nancy Zimfer was sent into that job. She stepped down now, I think, in the last year or so. But she was sent in to do that work. And now she's working with Ridgelane as well, with Michael Crow. The history is really important. Some of you guys may know Mark Tucker, if you've ever heard of the Dear Hillary letter, which I highly recommend you read. It's usually like shared around by conservative people, but actually it was read into the congressional record, so it's an actual document, like a primary source. You know, it's not just hearsay. But essentially, everything in the Dear Hillary letter is what is coming with planned regional economies and apprenticeships and reskilling. And these planned economies are going through it's the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act that was passed under Obama. So regions have, like, preferred economic constructs. So different regions have different sectors that they're supposed to feed kids into. And it really is running the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. They're running, there's a thing called ONET, which is essentially every job will have skills categories. And that is to match you against the blockchain. And that's out of Raleigh. But like Philadelphia, our regional, like our growth sector jobs, other than 2 of them, they all pay under $12 an hour, right? And so I'm going to our poverty committee hearings, our city council, who said, oh, maybe we should think about the gig economy, talking about that. Like, it hadn't occurred to them before, but they're pushing jobs that are not sustainable. But anyway, so the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, reshaping education for a workforce development pipeline came out of Mark Tucker. He was based in Rochester, and he was working for the Carnegie Foundation Corporation. And he was essentially set up to restructure American schools. So it's come from Goals 2000, Clinton Bush. It just continues forward. And he just recently stepped down, and I'm trying to remember who replaced him, but the guy who replaced him is actually from Australia. So this is out of Rochester, so it's not just New York City. But you should look up the Dear Hillary letter. And, oh, this is from it. So they're talking about not a human resource development system, a seamless web of opportunities to develop skills from cradle to grave, driven by client needs with clear standards. And so that is what we're, like, now they have the technology, right? Now they have blockchain. Now they have smart contracts. Now they're putting education transcripts on blockchain in Dallas and in Tulsa and in higher ed. They've got many pilots. I could give a three-hour talk just on, I gave like a three-hour talk on like blockchain education, which is coming. But they didn't have the technology in the late 80s when Mark Tucker first started, but they have it now, and that's coming. You know, the other key figure in this is IBM. So IBM is a major, major player in the space in blockchain education, and P-Tech, like work-based trained STEM jobs. So they're training up, you know, kids for the fourth industrial revolution. For the little kids, like, and this is really hard, I had to write a whole blog post about Sesame Workshop and their venture capital arm, and that they were essentially teamed up with IBM to data mine Syrian refugee kids with MacArthur money. So, and people are like, well, Sesame is so great. But if you actually look at Joan Ganz Cooney, who's been in it since the beginning, you know, they've pushed digital gamification, venture capital, and her husband, who is now deceased, but he was the chair of Lehman Brothers, and he founded Blackstone. So, like, ever since the very beginning, Sesame Workshop has been an extension. And even the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which I did not know, was backed by Carnegie. The early head had ties to MIT and the War Machine, and it was like the very first public-private partnership. So, you know, so this is Stanley Druckenmiller and Jeffrey Canada. So all of these I skipped through, but the Harlem Children's Zone, it has been the space to pilot all of these equations, because it really is data and equations and rules. So they've had a long lead on this, and I talk about the fact that, you know, Paul Tudor Jones, whose Robinhood money was funneling into Harlem Children's Zone, they have this book of 168 pages of equations. Like, if you give a poor kid glasses, this is the economic return. You know, if you solve their parents' diabetes, this is the return. Back and forth it goes. And now they have the equations ready to go. But Paul Tudor Jones, the hedge fund, he got his start in cotton futures trading. Like, he's from Tennessee, he's in Connecticut now, but his start was in cotton futures trading. So, you know, the way in which these wraparound services, which are really central to the Harlem Children's Zone, are now for everybody. Everybody's going to have wraparound services. You know, I've spoken about Bloomberg, but again, talking about domain awareness system and the security state. You guys, New York City is the home of Sidewalk Labs, right? So that's Google, Alphabet's Smart Cities program. And essentially, at NYU, Paul Romer is talking about like charter cities or carve-outs where you have like special exception zones where you could just like hand a zone over, you know, to a company. And I know there's been a lot of pushback in Toronto about Sidewalk Labs there, but really they would like, Google would like to have your own like communities where they can set the rules, and they will be smart communities, and, you know, they'll have the policing, and if you're unhoused, they'll come put you on a pay for success pathway. Another person is Neil Kleiman. I saw him speak at Penn. He's a professor at NYU. He is the progressive. Stephen Goldsmith out of Harvard is the conservative, so they've teamed up on a new operating system for the city. So all of these smart contracts have to run on e-government and digital identity. And so he's a key figure in that bit. Deborah Estrin was actually, she came out of UCLA, and she is now based at Cortell Technion on Roosevelt Island in New York City. They have a small data lab that's tracking all the health data. But she was early on, she chaired this committee in 2001 called Embedded Everywhere, and this was before they were really talking about Internet of Things. But in 2001, they were already identifying sensors spread throughout the everyday environment, people's activities recorded and shaped by computing systems, and that will shift from computers to smart desks and swallowable health monitors in automated buildings. So that's like 20 years ago. So Deborah Estrin was chaired that committee. Now she's at Cortell Technion, the small data lab. And what's really interesting is, like, if I actually went there, because I do landscape, so I actually like to see these things and actually go there. I went to Liebman at Harvard, like the social impact bond lab. I just wanted it, like, the banality of evil. Oh, it lives in a cubicle and it looks like this. But I went to the campus to see Bloomberg and Google kind of got that all started. And there's the smallpox. The smallpox ruin is like in this area, State Park. And then there's the FDR Park, and it overlooks the United Nations. Right? So it's very symbolic, like if you actually think about, and you know, they're looking to data mine your health as a commodity. So this guy, J.P. Pollack, is also at Cortel Technion and the Small Data Lab. He co-founded as the architect of Common Pass, right? So the COVID pass is going to tell you where you can go, what you can do, is also about data mining your health. And he actually also has some creepy stuff with zoology, because we have to understand the UN Sustainable Development Goals are about keeping people away from nature and nature away from people. And they're going to say it's for all of our safety, right? And the World Bank has a whole program called One Health to keep people separate. And so zoology, understanding the role of zoology and public health is really important. He also was part of WellCoin. So this is essentially what we're talking about, is tokenizing good behavior. Like in the future, in the augmented reality world where we are not going to be allowed to have real work, is behavioral compliance to a pathway for impact investors. And we'll track it on blockchain and give you scrip in coins for behaving. So there he is. There he is on Common Pass. But there's like 60 board. Like, you should look at the board. It's huge. It's very influential. The other piece is that Google Alphabet is in health, blockchain health. And they call it City Block. So you have your smart city, and then you have your smart health system. It's on blockchain, and it's specifically targeting complex urban populations, if you want to read between the line on that one. So So there you go. So yeah, so that's one of my maps of the Cornell Tech. And yeah, so I'll just wrap up. So data as currency. They're feeding it to try to hasten the singularity. All of that data, you know, until we're made obsolete, you know, blend with the cloud, is informing data, predictive analytics. And that's both for financial markets, and I think we also have to understand it as military signals intelligence, like within these digital twinning and modeling communities. The digital twinning is coming with more and more sophisticated virtual simulations. If they can push us into virtual worlds, they can control us and they can extract further value. So you can imagine, like within capitalism, finite consumption in the real world, push you into a video game, guess what? You can maybe have three versions of you, right? You could have all different kinds of versions of you, and they could data mine all of you, virtually, as, like, multiples. It's kind of like that crazy, what was that Michael Keaton movie, Multiplicity, where he, like, cloned himself, only it's just in a video game, so it's, like, a lot easier. Essentially, the geolocation data and the satellite systems are these open-air prisons that are guiding us like domestic livestock. And this biosecurity, people need to know that this is not a one-off. It's not just like, at this point, I'm not talking the particulars of COVID anymore. It doesn't really, I mean, it is what it is. People know what, it's because the next one, they've got bunch lined up, right? Like when they need it, Goldman Sachs has like a whole division. They have an effective lockdown index with Google and Oxford. Like, it's not the COVID lockdown index. It's an effective, whenever Goldman Sachs needs to lock down the globe, if Goldman Sachs can lock down the globe. And that's what we're looking at if we don't resist the whole structure that is coming. It's the biosecurity state. Yeah, so the health passports, it's all linked to the Sustainable Development Goals. I think I skipped over some of that, but goal 3 is health. And these derivatives markets are being in training, education, and healthcare, and like, we're going to be subjected to these digital interventions whether we like it or not. And, like, so this year's flu shot is what it is, but, like, I'm telling you, in a couple years, it's going to be with a Perfusa biosensor. And are you going to be able to say no thank you to that level of intervention? The Green New Deal is ultimately going to be about this totalitarian poverty management. It's not what people think. And so much of it is the branding. Like, I'm all for right relationships with, like, we need to heal the earth, each other. We need to be respectful. We need to pursue degrowth. There are many elements of this. But the Green New Deal is not that. I mean, and that's why, like, when you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez came out, I'm like, wait a minute. Goldman Sachs is a whole green bond market, right? Like, does she not know about Goldman Sachs' green bond market and their smart social impact bonds for water management? And Goldman Sachs, like, who is not telling her that? Like, it's a branding program that they hope people won't know till it's too late, that it's all built on the Internet of Bodies. And, yeah, so you have a lot of players here. So Anyway, this is just my fun thing. I just like close with this is Tagen, but like I'm just gonna let me read this one section. So this is a book about Robin Wall Kimmerer's, but they talk about Chittagan. This is from Robin Wall Kimmerer's book, Braiding Sweetgrass. It's not that book, but it's talking about her book. But it says, to become Chittagan, she will urge, by tending those who are already such, human and others, present and past, trusting the generosity of intelligence not our own, and gifts that we did not create. And so I want to leave you with the hopefulness, is that we all have, like, medicine. She talks about medicine for the bundle, right? Everybody has the thing that they can bring to this struggle. And I'm trying to provide a framing. Like, I'm happy to engage. I'm sorry I wasn't able to, like, fully articulate the whole social impact bond finance piece of it, but it's coming. I mean, these models of blockchain identity, the Edley securitization platforms, the plan for social impact securitization, that is coming. Whether they can fully scale it and how quickly is the question, but I think we should all agree that nobody's child, nobody's parent, nobody's sick person, you know, nobody should be a commodity on blockchain. And I have a friend who we collaborate a lot because she's in Silicon Valley. She's a professor at San Jose State. And she's also the chair of the education committee for the San Jose NAACP. And so we actually collaborated on a resolution that passed at their national meeting last year that essentially said they would oppose any compulsory linkage of a blockchain identity to any public benefit service access. Right? So you should not, I'm going to skip back because I had to skip over this to, but this is really important to talk about. And this is why there's a lot in here, guys. Alice, I need you to look at this. Okay, this. So this is the money slide, all right? This is from the task force, the Illinois Blockchain Task Force Working Group. And you have to understand, Illinois, Chicago, commodities trading, right? There's a geography to this. This is a thought experiment. So this has not yet been put in place, but they're like, how can we play with this equipment? This seems very interesting, right? So in this social benefits distribution case snapshot, so this is about food assistance programs, where you have the individual, they get a digital identity with a benefit wallet. In this wallet, you can buy... you buy your food, and you either make the good choice, as they have decided, the apple, or the bad choice, the hamburger. If you make the preferred choice, they will ding you back a little bit extra money to your wallet. So essentially, now this whole system is predicated on an understanding. It's a behavioral nudge, and nudges are a big part of this whole what works government, Bloomberg, behavioral economic structure. And people are like, well, that's it. People should eat more apples. I don't have a problem with that. Well, the thing is, ultimately, it's pushing the condition. And they'll say, oh, we'll tie this to UN Sustainable Development Goal 3 and health. And everybody should be so much healthier because they have to buy the good stuff, right? But this doesn't look at the fact that maybe this individual lives in a food desert. Maybe this individual works 3 jobs. And maybe they don't have maybe they don't have a full kitchen to prepare their food, or time to cook it. You know, and I'm not making justifications, but there are structural elements, very racialized structural elements in how people manage their food choices and what's available to them that this structure doesn't address at all. And then you can imagine that, like, give this thing a couple years and say, well, you know what? We're just going to pare back on that benefit a little bit. Because you know what? If they're always making the good choice, they don't need that much money, right? And then eventually it'll be like, you can only get to the end of the month if you always make the right choice, whether or not to make that choice is possible or impossible. And for a lot of people, you know, it may be impossible to make the choice that's determined. And in this, it's not just food, right? You could apply this to a health intervention, right? Which is preferred and which is not preferred. This could be an education curriculum, which is preferred and which is not preferred. And who gets to decide? Does Goldman Sachs get to pick? Does UBS Bank get to pick? Does SoftBank get to pick? Who gets to pick what is the good thing? Because the good thing, like, the logic dictates that they will make choices that are to their advantage. Whether or not maybe it works out for you or not, they will not set up a structure that works to their disadvantage. Mm-hmm. And what I want to say is that if we allow a global police state, a surveillance state, to be built on blockchain that runs on poverty management, and it's profitable for someone, it's crazy to think that they're going to have less poverty. If it's profitable, you only have more poverty. it's slightly better managed, right? I mean, that's the logic of this. And I'm not saying, you know, that's just how it's going to go. And so, I don't think I got to talk about this piece, but what do these things look like? Okay, so here's the retinal scan for Syrian refugees for their grocery payments. So that's being piloted. In the UK, the National Health Service has bought 5.8 million of these Shop With Your DNA nudge bands, right? So they already got it, and they're attaching it to COVID, right? So now they got all your DNA and say, oh, okay, well, you need food assistance? Well, just so you know, here's your trusty nudge band. This is what you're allowed to eat, by the way. Or we'll incentivize you to eat the right things that match your DNA, which is incredibly, like, there's a huge eugenics element to this, too. And I would have to say, like, that the interoperable data systems, Data Zone is the model in Santa Clara County. It was backed by Chan Zuckerberg. Priscilla Chan is the medical individual in that partnership. She keynoted at the launch of the Silicon Valley Regional Data Trust. That's this giant interoperable data system in San Jose. Like 500,000 kids are in it. David Hausler was at the kickoff for that. And he was the person who put the genomic sequence on the internet. So why was he there if there's not going to be a genomic component in this profiling, right? And there's a really interesting piece about Dominic Cummings, I think, who is Boris Johnson's like right-hand man, and he's going to remake the NHS for digital and mine it for AI. And he's like straight up a eugenicist. I mean, he's talking about, like, you know, relationships and environment don't matter. Your genes determine your future. We're going to determine your educational opportunities based on your genetic code. And in that global education futures timeline that had the people in there, people as portfolio commodities, one of the items was a student genetic passport. So this stuff never went away. And the thing for me that was really shocking is I think of stuff as like, you know, I call myself like a recovering liberal. And then I thought I was left, and then I don't know now. But like I'm not, you know. But when I was looking at Michael Young, who's the father of social entrepreneurship in the UK, he started this idea of social entrepreneurship, right, making money off of social problems. But he was the thought leader for the Labour Party in the UK in the post-World War II era. And he was part of the Fabian Society, and the Fabian Society started the London School of Economics, which is integral with all of this. So really there is an unpleasant element on the leftist side to eugenics and paternalism embedded in social care that's hard to deal with. And like, I don't know how we, which is not to say people aren't deserving of it, but I think we just have to understand that history for it to make sense. Because as soon as I saw that, I'm like, well, of course it's in the United Kingdom and the NHS. Like, of course that is how it would happen. So, but don't give up, guys, because like we are really like, the more people know, the better. I mean, you know, it is coming after everyone, and we don't want it. Like, I can't imagine any individual in the world who would want that for themselves or their children or their grandchildren or who's coming. I can't, it's not like, oh, maybe it's 50-50 people who want. Nobody wants it except for the billionaires, and they're sociopaths. So we just have to, like, get it together. But, like, the challenge is that we're so fragmented right now, politically, partisanly, people not really understanding what the structure is, that we have to figure out a way. But it has to acknowledge the history, like the historic precedent and the trajectory, but to fragment just along identity politics lines is not going to be, we're not going to be able to get enough people that way. So we have to, like, figure out some sweet spot there that we, like, know the history and acknowledge the history and then, like, and look to that history and then, like, rise.